What are the forgotten tools of tradecraft? Which objects might unlock the hidden history of espionage? I'm Alice Loxton, and this is a history of the world in spy objects from Spyscape Studios. An item for your consideration, once belonging to one of the most famous spies of all time, which, granted, sounds like a contradiction in terms. For a spy to become famous, something, somewhere, has to have gone deeply wrong. That's certainly true of Francis Gary Powers. You're about to meet his son, Gary Jr., born in 1965, and brought up inside the insular community of the US Air Force, on a base near Albany, Georgia. From his earliest memories, he was fascinated by the stories of his father's work.
When I was a little kid, I remember seeing a picture of myself in my dad's flight suit. The arms were too long, the legs were too long, the helmet was on my head crooked because my head was small.
The uniform that Gary is describing was worn by a very select group of pilots. It was designed for those, like Gary's father, who flew U-2 spy planes. Tailor-made for each individual, the suit fitted like a leotard, very tight and uncomfortable. But it had to be.
In the event of depressurization at 70,000 feet, the flight suit would inflate and thereby allow the pilot to stay alive at that altitude. It would be like his own compression chamber, his own airtight, hermetically sealed suit, which he could live in for a sustained period of time before getting back to an altitude where he could breathe oxygen on his own.
Laced up in his high-tech suit, Francis Gary Powers made dozens of reconnaissance flights over Cold War enemy territory. Not that his family, or anyone else, had any idea what was going on. They believed he was a NASA weather pilot. In truth, he'd been recruited to the CIA in 1956, right at the birth of the U-2 program.
In 1956, when these planes started to fly over foreign hostile countries, the pilots were breaking the then record every day of altitude that these planes could fly. But they could not boast or brag about it. It was a top secret mission. It was a black program. That means that it was covert and that it was very, very secretive. So these missions were successful up until May 1st, 1960.
Perhaps the date sounds familiar. It's been immortalized in countless Cold War history books since. On May 1st, 1960, Powers takes off from a military airbase in Pakistan. His mission, the first of its kind, is to fly undetected all the way across the Soviet Union. Everything begins without a hitch. Close your eyes and picture the majestic U-2. Soaring 73,000 feet above the Ural Mountains of Western Russia.
The U-2 is a very beautiful plane. The wings are 80 foot long, the fuselage is 40 foot long. It is very graceful in the air when it's flying. It wants to fly. There's so much lift that the wings produce that it's very hard to land. When you're at altitude, you can actually see the curvature of the Earth. You can make out certain features from that altitude with the naked eye, but it's the cameras on the U-2 that really take the photographs that are then able to be blown up so that the analysts can specifically look at the missiles and the other facilities that are the targets for these flights.
It's for those photographs that Powers is risking his hide, flying high above a hostile nation. Remember, this is the first time any U-2 has strayed so far and so boldly into Soviet territory. And the timing of the operation is key. Frosty Soviet-US relations are beginning to thaw. A Paris summit is planned in 2 weeks' time, where Nikita Khrushchev and President Eisenhower will meet and talk. A stray US plane is the last thing the Russians expect to pop up on their radars. And yet, that's exactly what they find. And they do not hesitate to act.
After 4 years of successful missions, my father was shot down by a new and improved Soviet SA-2 missile over the city of Sverdlovsk.
As his plane tumbles through the sky, Powers desperately tries to free himself from the damaged cockpit. In the pocket of his flight suit sits a very special device given to all U-2 pilots, with this scenario in mind. It's hidden within an American silver dollar.
The coin was a hiding place for a small poison-tipped pin that could be used in the event of torture. It was explained to the pilots that if they're caught, they will be tortured, and that this was a way to alleviate the pain and suffering. The coin was optional to take and optional to use. And when I mean use, I mean pricking the pilot with the pin that is sticking out of the coin. The original coin my father threw away over a Soviet field when he was parachuting down to the ground, but he did keep the pin with him just in case of torture. When he was bailing out of the aircraft, he thought that the coin was a very bad hiding place because Russians would want a silver dollar as a keepsake, a memento, a souvenir. So he thought that was a very bad place to hide this device. He threw the coin away after taking the pin out and putting it in his flight suit pocket.
When Powers hits the ground, the KGB are ready and waiting. He is captured and taken to Moscow. Can you even imagine the chaos back home, in the States? The government quickly deploy Powers' old cover story. He's a weather pilot gone astray. But who's going to believe that? And somehow, the U-2 survived its crash. In the scramble to eject, Powers had failed to activate the surveillance camera's self-destruct mechanism. When the Russians located the plane with its intact high-tech cameras, they knew exactly why Powers was there. The Paris summit was cancelled, and Powers was convicted of espionage. His sentence, 10 long years in Soviet prison. And at first, that's where Powers' government left him. They suspected him of crossing over to the other side and divulging closely guarded secrets. How else could he have stayed alive? Better to leave him to rot in that Russian cell. But back home, trouble was brewing. Powers' wife, Barbara, was in a downward spiral, drink driving, getting into trouble with the cops. She was ultimately committed to a psychiatric ward, where the CIA could keep tabs on her. But there were fears that Gary would find out. If he did, he may be tempted to give away even more. So the government changed tack. They tabled the idea of a spy exchange. Francis Gary Powers for the Soviet spy, Rudolf Abel. And what do you know? The Soviets were interested.
The Glenaker Bridge is what separates East and West during the Cold War in Potsdam, Germany. On the west side is West Berlin. On the east side is East Germany. The bridge spans the Havel River. During the Cold War time period, it was barbed wire. There were posts and guard shacks on either end. There were gates that would come down in the middle to prevent anybody from crossing over. It was a restricted area. No one was allowed to cross the bridge during the Cold War. This bridge was the perfect location for a spy exchange. And at 6 in the morning, on February 10th, 1962, when the spy exchange took place, it was basically deserted except for the people who had to be there for this exchange to take place. There are patrols of soldiers with German shepherds walking back and forth. There's a gunboat in the water underneath doing patrols.
Two spies at either end of a bridge. At the other end sits their respective freedom, tantalizingly close.
My dad did describe his feelings on the bridge, And I remember him telling me as a kid when I'd ask him questions, what was it like to be exchanged, Dad? He basically relayed what I just told you about, but he also indicated that he had made up his mind that he was not going to go back to a Soviet prison. If something happened and the deal was called off and the exchange started to be canceled, he had determined that he would run for it, dive into the water, and take his chances. He was not going to be taken back to a Soviet prison.
As fate would have it, Powers was never to feel the rush of that ice-cold water, nor would he ever again see the inside of his Soviet cell. Instead, he crossed the bridge to freedom. But it wasn't the end of Francis Gary Powers' ordeal. Back home, he was met with a frosty reception, criticized for failing to destroy the plane, and for never making use of that poison pin that sat in his flight suit. It was only after extensive debriefing that opinion began to turn. With time, Powers would be recognized for his courage and his achievements. Finally, he would resume his American life, divorcing his first wife, Barbara, and marrying Sue, the mother of Gary Jr. Gary grew up with a hero for a father, a man who'd talk about his experiences in the tight cockpit of a U-2 spy plane, with a certain glint in his eye. And now, as a man, Gary is obsessed with discovering all that he can about his father's secret life.
I have been doing research on my father and the U-2 incident the past 30 plus years. I have retraced my father's steps to the Soviet Union, well, to Russia today. I've been in Moscow several times. I've seen the U-2 wreckage on display at the Central Armed Forces Museum. I've been to Sverdlovsk, which is now called Yekaterinburg, and I was able to see the impact craters where the U-2 hit the ground after being shot down. I was able to visit one of the missile bases that fired the SA-2 missiles at his plane on May 1st. So I've had a very good journey by interacting with people that were there at the time, talking to family members of people who were there at the time, and even talking to my father's contemporaries and colleagues who were alive when he was doing those missions. When the son, Sergei, reached out to me and asked to meet with me, at first I wasn't sure what to expect.
There's another, less told story from the 1st of May, 1960. One that looms large in Gary's reconstruction of the event. In the scramble to gun down the American U-2, the Russians accidentally shot down one of their own planes. And its pilot, one Sergei Safronov, wasn't as lucky as Powers. He ejected from his aircraft, but suffered terrible and eventually fatal injuries. When he died, he left behind a young wife, Anna, and a son. It was this Sergei that reached out to Powers all those years later.
It was a very unique experience to meet Sergei. Through an interpreter, we were able to set up a date to meet at the Cold War Museum and have a conversation. It was a very nice conversation. He was very genuine, as was I. And we talked for about 2 hours. About what it was like for him to grow up as a kid with a father who was a MiG pilot who had been killed on May 1st. We talked about my life growing up in the shadow of a famous figure after my father was shot down on May 1st. One of the most profound things he said to me is he told me that his mother wanted to relay a message to me. And he said that his mother did not blame my father for her husband's death. And that was really felt to the heart. I thought it was very nice to know that there was no animosity between our two families and that we both understood that the pilots were following orders and it wasn't their fault or my father's fault that his father had passed away.
The connection between these two pilots and their families says something about the shared experience of all the men and women who don a flight suit or a uniform, and fight on behalf of their governments, irrespective of allegiance. In the end, these two pawns at opposite ends of the board understood each other better than the powers for whom they risked their lives. Alice Loxton. More secrets await in the next episode of A History of the World in Spy Objects from Spyscape Studios. Listen early and ad-free with Spyscape Plus on Apple Podcasts and explore the collection on spyscape.com/spyobjects.